Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio and the Writer's Block. You know, there's a real dark time ahead for some children and families in need this holiday season. So as you plan your limited holiday parties or just give some thought to the needs of some, how about you think about canned or non-perishable foodstuffs or possibly an inexpensive toy taken to your local Toys for Tots Center. Take the food to the nearest food bank or food distribution center. You can find locations online in your city, and you would be making a lot of folks' holidays a lot better knowing they can feed their kids and themselves, and possibly give their kids a small gift or two. So how about you give what you can this season? And now please settle in for a brand new episode of The Writer's Block, and happy holidays from all of us at The Writer's Block and LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Suck it up, Santa. We are your elves. Welcome to the Writer's Block and LA Talk Radio. This is your host, Jim Christina, and I am on the air right now with my good friend and co-host of 5.5 years, Miss Bobby Jean Bell.
Hey, I'm calling in from Albuquerque, where we had snow this morning.
I know, it's what you said, and we're going to have it for the next 4 days. So,
entertain you while you're snowed in, right?
I just got a book from our guest that's going to be on January 11th. That's like 411 pages. So, yes, I will have something to do for the next 3 or 4 weeks. Absolutely. And you're doing good. I never dreamt, and I have to say that moving to Idaho was, I mean, it was, you know, we're retired, so we had to get out of the rat race and the expense and everything else of California. And but moving to Idaho was like a real culture shock for us. I mean, our neighbors now are like cows. and now it's becoming cows and like Santa's elves, they're running around out in the fields going, and you go, whoa. Oh, my God. So it's so much fun. I mean, up here is like winter, and we have 4 seasons. Mm-hmm. So it's like awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like I grew up in Southern California, like a lot of us did, and we never had 4 seasons, And now we have like winter and spring and summer and fall and leaves fall, and you know, it's just like awesome. It's just like wow. It's like life is supposed to be.
Well, that's what I experienced almost all of my life until we moved from New England to California in 91.
Yeah.
So yeah.
and then you had to have found it lacking somewhat and whatever it was that you were lacking. I mean, fall leaves and...
Well, you know, the hardest thing actually was this time of year, because in California, songs about snow and, there's palm trees, you know, everywhere.
I know. It's like 80 and, degrees.
And that was a little, you know, that was a little jarring. But you find your holiday seasons and your traditions and the things that you love. You know, you find them no matter where you live, and every area has its own fun kind of take on it. You know, I'd never seen flocked snow trees before. We didn't have that in New England, you know.
Me either. And, you know, to be honest with you, I've never seen Santa Claus in surfing jams. But apparently, California is like full of them. So, hey. God love you, Santa, wherever you are, wherever you're going to be on the 24th. just don't forget to stop by my house.
That's right.
There you go. Okay. Hey, we have a returning guest tonight. The guy is like phenomenal. He's a pulp fanatic and he's the master. He's the master of Pulp Fiction. I guess that's the best way of putting it. The man is just like, everything he writes is like so much fun to read, yet almost dystopian, but never quite there. It's always kind of like right on the cusp of pulp and dystopian and like, now I'll let him know.
And like action figures,
Superman and Batman.
Yeah, keep standing back up again. Well, at least the main character in the book we're going to talk about tonight.
Exactly.
Nothing gets him down.
Welcome back to the Writer's Block for his third visit with us, and never to be outdone by the previous two. Please welcome Mr. Gary Phillips.
well, Jim and Bobby G, thanks for having me back.
Oh, man, you know what? It's so much fun having you on because, you know, we're both fans of pulp. But, you know, we discussed this, your very first visit with us, probably in 2015, I think it was.
Yeah. Wow.
Early on.
And it's like, explain to our audience, who is getting quite massive, what pulp fiction really is.
Well, it's a great question. I mean, it's one of those things that originally was because of economics, was an actual physical entity, and then it sort of took on its own style. So very briefly, pulp fiction really originates in the 30s, but even then it really has antecedents, of course, with the Penny Dreadfuls and what have you, even before then, But pulp fiction sort of starts in the 30s at the beginning and the height of the Great Depression, and these were at first 10-cent magazines, and then I guess they eventually went to 25 cents. So yeah, so pulp has its antecedents even before the 1930s in the Penny Dreadfuls from I guess really the turn of the century. Ned Buntline, I guess, is somewhat because he made Buffalo Bill Cody into the legend, into Buffalo Bill Cody that we know today, or at least the one we know from the movies. So anyways, all that to say is that in the 30s, as the Great Depression came on, and we didn't have, you know, the internet, there wasn't even really TV then, right?
No.
And so what you had was radio, and you had print. And so the pulp magazines, Street and Smith was one of the big pulp publishers. I guess Condé Nast was even around then. And so for 10 cents, and then I think eventually a quarter, you would buy these monthly magazines on the stand. And pulp really referred to it. Initially it referred to the kind of cheap paper that the magazine would print on, where you literally could see pieces of the wood pulp in the paper, because it was a cheap way to make these magazines. They would have four color covers. They would have full color covers. And they would have these stories on the inside, and they often have spot illustrations, or black and white illustrations for the stories. And the pulp magazines created various characters who are still around today. The Shadow, which I believe is being revived now by James Patterson. Doc Savage, and there's been some talk of a Doc Savage movie, and now there's even talk of, I guess, of a Doc Savage television show, a cable show. Although there was a Doc Savage movie in the 70s that George Powell did. The writer could buy these monthly magazines. And they had sports stories, you had science fiction stories, adventure stories, et cetera, et cetera. And in the front of the magazine would be what they called the novel length adventure, which usually was some story that was 50 to 60,000 words. And then it was backup short stories. And so pulp, as I said, initially referred to the kind of paper they were printed on, but because the writers of pulp had to grind out these stories so quickly and so, you know, and so furiously, to make their deadlines, as well, of course, to make their money. And there was a certain staccato style and a certain kind of brevity of the way you told the story, a lot of action, a lot of, you know, people going through windows, a lot of gunfire, to keep the reader interested, right? To keep the keep the pages turning, a lot of cliffhangers.
Sure.
It became where pulp comes from.
Mm-hmm. Now, your new book, Matthew Henson and the Ice Temple of Harlem. It's definitely a pulp story. I mean, there's no doubt in my little tag in mind that it is. But it almost slaps on the Superman / Batman storyline. Not storyline, but character.
But character. Yet, well certainly, Jim, it really harkens to one of the characters who came out of pulp, as I mentioned, was Doc Savage, who was a larger-than-life character, who in fact influenced some of the trappings of what got transported to Superman, and of course, and even the creator of Batman, Bob Kane, and Bill Finger talk about the fact that it was Zorro and some other characters. Who contributed to, or even the Black Bat, who was in fact a pulp character, who contributed to what became Batman in the comics. So absolutely, in this version, Matthew Henson, who was in fact a real life person, mm-hmm. who was in fact one of the people that reached the North Pole, I reimagine him, in this context, just as we reimagine Buffalo Bill Cody and Belle Starr.
Sure.
And various versions of the Earp brothers and mm-hmm. The whole gunfight of the OK Corral. Jesse James, of course, as we know, has got many a different kind of treatment of who he really was. So I think in that vein, I've taken Henson, and this story is set in 1928. So it's right before the crash, right before the stock market tanks in 29. And so this is kind of the height of what was called the Harlem Renaissance in Harlem, which is kind of an intellectual and artistic firmament of the day, and that's where the character is set.
Yeah,
and he's the kind of character that every guy wants to be, and every woman wants to know him.
As long as you say that, Bobby G, because in this era of Me Too, I don't want to be. I certainly wouldn't. I'm an old man, but even I know better than to say certain things on the radio. I don't want to get in trouble. But yes, in my heart of hearts, yes, absolutely, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. By golly,
you put the story back in the 1920s. Yeah. And your vernacular and your dialogue and everything is actually fitting to the time period, which is amazing because I don't know too many writers who can go back that far and get that accurate.
Well, even I'm not that old, Jim, but ever since I've been a kid, this is way before the days of TCM, and God bless TCM for bringing back all these old movies. But when I was a kid growing up, man, I would watch all these Edward G. Robinson and the Bogart movies.
I know,
oh my God, who am I? I'm blanking on the great. I can't. Jimmy Cagney. My God, I'm so old. I can't remember the man's name. Jimmy Cagney.
Yeah.
Right. I watched all those great '30s movies. Right. And so, of course, all that patter. And all those crazy, antiquated slang words are ingrained in my brain. So it wasn't that hard. It wasn't hard to reach back.
No, actually, they are in the black and white noir. You're absolutely right because you can throw in Humphrey Bogart in that slot as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And movies like Laura. And all of those movies back in the 40s.
Or Public Enemy with Cagney Paul Muni. What is it? I'm a prisoner from a chain gang. No, is it something? Something from a chain gang. I'm a fugitive. I'm a fugitive from a chain gang. That's a Paul Muni movie. I'm trying to remember. Anyway, all that to say is that of course, in those days. When I was a kid, it was like, I guess it was the Million Dollar Movie
Million Dollar Movie on Channel 9. That's exactly right.
Exactly. That's right.
Hey, look, we're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be back with you, Gary. Don't go away, please. If you hang up, Don't.
No, no.
Okay. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is a writer's block. I am your host, Jim Christina. We'll be back right after this brief word from LA Talk Radio.
Hi, Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And you know, these days of coronavirus and COVID-19, as you're sitting home at your desk doing your job, how about instead of watching reruns of Lassie and the Lone Ranger, you tune in to www.latalkradio.com and listen to what our hosts have to say during the day. We've got everything from sports to music to self-help to, well, we even have talk. So why not give us a try during the day? latalkradio.com. And remember, every Thursday night, 6 p.m. Pacific, right here on LA Talk Radio, is the Writer's Block. Have a great day.
And we are back in the studio with Mr. Garrick Phillips and, of course, my friend, co-host, and she's been around for 5.5 years on this show, Ms. Bobby G. Bell. And if you want to call and talk to Gary Phillips tonight, the number here in the studio is 323-0815. And again, that number is, because I screwed it up, 323-203-0815. And you can call and our engineer will pick you up and he'll let us know that you're on the line. And you can talk to Gary or myself or Bobby or, golly, anybody you want to talk to, I guess. I don't know. Okay. We are back with Gary. Now, you know what? I was thinking earlier when I was reading your book, Matthew Henson, there's a lot of similarities between Matthew Henson and a lot of the other pulp heroes from the 40s and 30s, 40s and 50s.
Right.
And a lot of them were like on Saturday afternoon matinees and the serials that we used to go to see when we were kids in the theaters.
Yeah.
Like Zorro's the Fighting Legion and the Lone
Ranger.
Exactly. Silver. And I was thinking, you know, even though we've had this conversation before, it always amazes me every time I get into your pulp stuff, which I love, incidentally.
Thanks.
It's like reminds me so much of when I was a kid, of all the stuff I used to watch when I was. And you're right, Million Dollar Movie, man, right. That was a plethora of good stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, it was on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times a week. Plus Saturday and Sunday, 4 times each. That means 13 times a week it was on. The same movie. But it was wonderful. It truly was wonderful. And if you grew up in Southern California like we did, then you know that. Bobby, you unfortunately grew up in Connecticut or wherever it was. Back there where they didn't have the Million Dollar Movie. But, I mean, it was like really cool, huh, Gary?
It was. Well, and you know, but also, you know, I should hasten to add, Jim, that I think somewhat distinct from this novel would be considered as they might say, it's considered sort of a new pulp, which is to say, it is a pulp novel. It's definitely set in that time period, but it's also unlike, say, some of the pulps from that period. It does reflect the time period, so. Sometimes you would read, and I grew up when I was in high school, when they started to reprint the Doc Savage novels in paperback. That, you know, I always have one in my back pocket on my way to football practice. The one thing you would note about those novels, and even the Shadow novels and the Spider and so on and so on, there was very little mention of the real world. There was very little mention of like the depression that was raging then, right? There was very little mention of soup kitchens and what have you. And not to say that, you know, I'm taking you down that path in the book, but I do mention the real world. I do posit that, you know, Matthew Henson exists in a real time period. I mean, this, as I said, it's right before the depression, but part of the subplot is about Dutch Schultz, who was an actual, you know, real figure, who was trying to move in on the numbers racket in Harlem, which actually is true. And one of the bosses of the numbers racket is, in fact, Stephanie St. Clair, Queenie St. Clair, and she, you know, she's in the book. So there are some realities that I posited in the book. I think hopefully it's an entertaining read, but it's also a book that also looks at, you know, issues of that time period. The fact that because Matthew Henson was black, did not get the kind of accolades due him once he got back from the North Pole that, say, Robert Peric got, who was the head of the expedition, or let alone, by the way, that the four Inuit gentlemen, you know, hardly ever got mentioned. And, of course, I do take pains to mention those guys, Uta in particular, who was in fact a buddy of Henson's, and Henson in fact did in fact learn the Inuit, some of the Inuit languages. So he was the only one on the expedition who actually talked to these guys, you know, in their native tongue. Sure. And I should, I'd be remiss if I did not mention, I've mentioned this several times and I'm going to mention it again. There are two books that really helped me in this process, which is one is Henson's book itself, which is not really a autobiography, but kind of a more of a memoir. And it was published in 1912 because they reached North Pole in 1909 after the seventh or eighth attempt to reach the pole. So there's two books. So it's Hinton's book, A Negro at the North Pole, which was published in 1912. And there was a professor, S. Allen Counter. And it just so happens that the edition of Hinton's book that I got happened to have an introduction by this professor, Professor Counter, who was I think he was a neurophysicist, but I know that he was a professor and taught at Harvard. And he was something of a Hensonologist. And so I tracked down Counter's book about Henson, Black, White, and Eskimo at the North Pole. And it was in Counter's book that he revealed things that neither Henson nor Peric revealed in their particular memoirs, which is important because which is what I use in the story, which is one, both Henson and Peric had Inuit kids, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And definitely for the pulp part of it, they brought back parts of this massive meteorite.
Yeah.
Meteor from the North, from this village in Greenland, which is right below the North Pole, right? Because when they were in the village, they saw that the folks in the village were using these iron tools, but there's no iron deposits, you know, in that part sure. of Greenland. And so they find out that, oh yeah, this is big friggin' rock that came from space that we've been, you know, chipping away from, you know, for years and years and years.
And so of course,
exactly. So having that component and the fact that Henson actually had this Inuit son, and Henson was married twice in the States, but he actually never had children here in the States. And the fact that they had these Inuit kids, or particularly for my purpose, for Henson having an Inuit son, and knowing the name of that son from Counter's book, in the 1980s, went back to that part of Greenland, and found these two surviving sons. I think Peric had a son and a daughter. I think the daughter had died somewhat young. And the two sons, who both had the same name, by the way, Peric's son and Henson's son, he brought them back to be feted and honored in the States. And it was Counter who was responsible to get, who petitioned then-President Reagan to get Henson moved from the cemetery where he was buried in Baltimore, because Henson's originally from Baltimore, and get him moved to Arlington to be reburied with honors at Arlington as Peric had been. I never go anywhere without trying to say, you know, all good things, both to Henson's biography, which puts me on the trail, and then certainly to S. Allen Counter, whose book and his efforts really, you know, honored Matthew Henson.
Can I just make a quick comment as a reader? This was a great romp, and there was so much name dropping. occasionally, I would sort of lose track of wait a minute, what's going on? What is it that we're really trying to accomplish? And you would mix this wonderful concoction of real people and made up people. And I began to have to sort of have, I'll admit, Wikipedia open, because I'd be like, okay, well, I know Bessie Coleman is like a real person. But what about this, you know, Hugo Renwick? Is that like a real person? and then, of course, I knew nothing about, I realized I really knew nothing about Perry really at all. And and it was wonderful to sort of delve into reading some about that. And then in Wikipedia, when Matthew was mentioned, it's like, yes, and at 12, you know, he went on, he'd been working in a retail store, and, you know, he goes off to be a, you know, cabin boy. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's like right out of this book.
But it's right out of Dickens. I mean, exactly.
Actually,
he runs away from his cruel stepmother. It's actually true.
Yeah.
And he makes his way back from D.C. to Baltimore at 12 and signs on to be a cabin boy. I mean, that's crazy. It's like, it's right out of Dickens.
It's
actually true. And kindly old Captain Childs sort of takes the kid under his wing and teaches him, you know, about using the sextant, and teaches him about the classics and the math and this and that.
Yeah.
And I just said, oh man, I you know, you can't beat that. You can't,
right.
You know, of course I added on to that, you know, with Hinton, you know, traveling in Asia and learning martial arts, which that didn't really happen, but what the heck,
but it
really
sense.
Gave me a great basis to really help to build the character out.
Well,
I'm
sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we were talking about movies before. I felt like you really do take us into some very lush buildings, mansions, and fabulous cabaret. It was so fun reading about Small's Paradise, where he does a radio show from.
Right.
I really felt almost like I was watching a serial. I could see, you know, maybe from watching some movies or whatever in my background, going like, I know what this is. I know where we are. I know. Wow. You know, so it felt so real. It really felt so real. It almost didn't feel like Pulp Fiction to me. It really felt real.
and you know, one of the things was, is that not only do you take us into well-heeled neighborhoods, but you also show us what Harlem was like in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And Harlem was not a cheap, rundown place in the 1920s. Harlem was like very expensive, and there was a lot of very, very expensive housing.
Well, apparently Harlem is getting expensive again as speculators are showing up. But but certainly during that time period, and certainly it was a tension between those who rented and those who owned the buildings. But but that's sort of the point, that the Harlem Renaissance was really this period in which, you know, Langston Hughes and all these sort of people, you know, Cab Calloway, all these people sort of emerged. And so you had all this stuff, this sort of rich environment upon which, and I must say that, because I had some familiarity with that, having had some cousins, actually, having had cousins on my mom's side who came of age in Harlem, but particularly because I have a couple of great books, you know, about that period of time, one in particular kind of a oral history of that time period. And so I was able to, some of that stuff I had used a little bit before. And then, of course, because I had it on my shelf, I was able to look up, you know, certain factual things or certain just sort of anecdotal things. It's always, it's really not the facts that really make the story. It's always the anecdotal stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's always the stuff on the street level. It's always the stuff that's remembered by the people who lived it or at least heard those stories. That's what makes it come to life. You know,
well, there's enough truth in it.
Yeah.
There's enough truth in it to make people interested in staying there and reading this story.
Yeah,
I think that's the magic in this book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take another real quick break, Gary. Don't go away. We'll be back in a minute. And right now, you're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. And right now, we're going to listen to a real brief word from out west.
Readers want tonight's featured title, Matthew Henson and the Ice Temple of Harlem by Gary Phillips, or any books by the Writer's Block featured authors, easy peasy. Just go to outwestshop.com, choose books and CDs from the toolbar, and from the drop-down menu, click Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Do it by December 16th, and you will get your order in time for Christmas. The Writer's Block book list features titles of our guests. Click a book cover for the link to the interview and to purchase. Explore all our book categories like seasonal celebrations, and we add new titles daily. One-stop shopping supports Out West and independent booksellers when you purchase books through our bookshop.org affiliate website. Remember, it's always a great day out west.
And we are back. It is now, oh my goodness, it is 6:34. And we are on the air with Gary Phillips and Bobby G. Bell. And if you want to call and talk to Gary tonight, the master, I mean the absolute master of Pulp Fiction, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And again, that number is 323-203-0815. Gary, let's switch trades for just a second. What got you into writing pulp? It's such a limited genre that there are not that many writers out there that still write pulp fiction. And what got you into writing this?
Well, I think, Jim, the longer story short, I do think there's there is a kind of growing subset, I guess, of writers who consider themselves sort of new pulp writers, and so some of that I've been part of, but you know, primarily I guess I'm a crime fiction writer. I write hard boiled fiction. I write noir stories, but I've always, as I said, you know, since I've been a kid, or at least since I was a teenager, and in those days,
we were never kids, Gary.
Yeah, exactly. We were never kids. We were never kids. But you know, in those days when they're like I said, when they're reprinting the Doc right. Savage books, and then right. they reprinted The Shadow, etc. So I've always been a fan of it. But I've also always been a fan of Bales, Hammett, Chandler, Chester Himes, and so on. And so, of course, I mean, eventually when I finally got around to writing my first novel, I guess that would be in the 90s, I wrote a Private Eye story because I always knew I was going to write a Private Eye story. But I guess always in the back of my head, I was thinking, well, you know, at some point I might try to tackle something in the, you know, in that Doc Savage, The Shadow vein, or even more, more modern incarnation, though he harkens back to all that, of course, mm-hmm. is Indiana Jones, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who's also something of a natural lineage to Henson, because he himself is a, you know, archaeologist and an explorer and all that, and his stories are set, I guess, in the 40s. Has always had an allure for me, and also being somebody who is not only been a comic book fan, but I've written a few comic books and graphic novels and this and that. So I guess all that to say is that, and I've written some pulp or new pulp kind of short stories, but I finally, for some reason, I knew about Matthew Henson for some time, and I knew about Bessie Coleman for some time. And then I just kind of, you know, started to fixate on it and just started to think, well, you know what? You know, I like I said, I've done these short stories, but I want to do a full blown, you know, sort of pulp novel. Even if I never do another one, I want to do this one. And once I figured out it was going to be Matthew Henson, and once I sort of went down that rabbit hole in terms of some of the research and some of the stuff I had to find, and some of the stuff that I knew and what have you, I just had to finish it. So really, that's kind of what brought me to. You know, to the book now, and you know, hopefully, as they say, if sales warrant, and if sales are decent, then hopefully I can revisit this character, you know, again.
Oh, yeah. We need more. we want more.
Well, very good. Thank you.
Pulp writers, I mean, we've interviewed a few, but they've been nouveau pulp. But nobody comes to the degree of the older pulp that you do. I guess I want to say it's noir pulp possibly.
There's certainly elements of that, right?
We don't get a lot of books with this type of dialogue and this type of story.
Yeah.
And they're always refreshing to us because you know, we read every book that comes across our desk, and sometimes it's a chore. And sometimes it's a real treat. And yours was a real treat. And,
well, thank you, Jim. Thank you so much.
No worries. I mean, you know, we'll tell you if we like the book, and we like the book. But then Bobby and I have always kind of been a sucker for the noir pulp and the older stuff. But when you decided you were going to sit down and write, what prompted you to go? I mean, I know you explained how you got into the genre, but what decided you to sit down and write? Because most of your pulp is noir. It really is. And except for the Chinese guy that was like a super Bruce Lee kind of dude. Most of your pulp is like really noir, and it's really interesting to read it because your dialogue is always spot on. Your stories are always spot on. But your decision to sit down and write that type of book had to have come from someplace. I mean, deep within your heart or your soul. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much that, Jim. It's just, like I said, I think once I, I guess all those psychological things that come into play, you know, thinking about my childhood now and whatever, and you know, now being, you know, a grandpa and thinking about, you know, my grandson now who just turned 6, and I don't know, I guess, you know, part of it's just thinking about, you look back and you look forward, right? Or however forward you look at this stage of the life. And but the idea that really the idea is that things I want to write, I try to get them done so that I don't have that regret about I should have done this or should have done that. And so I kind of glommed onto it. Once I sort of fixated on the idea that I'm going to do something with Matthew Henson, you know, and I've known about Henson reaching the North Pole all these years. And just the idea that once I sort of centered on the idea that, okay, I want to tell a story about this guy, but I don't want to tell you the North Pole story because that's going to be his past. That's going to be what has made him who he is. But I want to take him in a different kind of direction. I want to put him someplace different. I want to set him in motion in a different way. Although I want what happened, or at least how I reimagine what happened at the North Pole to play a part, you know, in his story. And I guess once I settled on that, or once I thought about that, and then once I read Henson's book, and certainly once I read Counter's book, I just knew that, well, okay, now I've got enough stuff. I've got enough, you know, sort of basic elements that now I want to tell you this story. And, you know, in the end, listen, I mean, I can't speak for all writers, but I can just speak for myself. I only write the story I want to read, right? I mean, you know what I mean? If I'm entertained by it, and if I can keep going by it, then hopefully that means other people are entertained by it. But honestly, if, you know, and I've done that. I worked on certain projects where, you know, it's for the money or it's for whatever. And it's, you know, if your heart's not in it, and like you said, Jim, if your soul's not in it, you know, man, then, you know, you gotta, you know, fine, you can write it, whatever, turn it in. Hopefully you do a professional job. But honestly, man, it's like, if I don't want to read the story, then why am I writing the story? You know?
Sure.
And so, you know, and I just, you know, I always fall in love with the characters, right? I always fall in love with what they're doing. And so once I can get in the skin, you know, of Henson and get in the skin of some of the other characters in the book, I just had to tell the story.
Yeah, well, I totally hear you because I fall in love even with my bad guys.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. That's exactly right.
Well, I liked that when you just mentioned his background and then bringing it forward. I thought it was so fun that, you know, he likes to sleep, you know, in the Arctic air. He likes to have the window open,
right,
you know.
Right,
and
right,
you
exactly.
give a lot of little, they're kind of little details that you right. wouldn't necessarily need to give us, right. but they ground us in this is the man that's that come, you know, he's a product of his past experiences,
right.
and
exactly.
they stay that, you know, certain things to stay with him. They're now right. part of who he is. And, right. And I liked, you know, that was something that may, endeared me to him, I guess.
Oh, good.
Some
good.
Of those
well,
pieces
you.
That
That's
you.
Good. Good.
That
yeah.
You
yeah.
Include.
Yeah. He's a great yeah, yeah, character. Yeah, yeah. Bobby.
Yes.
It's to that time of the evening.
Oh.
Would you like to ask
Gary
a question?
Okay. So, Gary, we always love to think about the new writers that are listening or the writers that are have been writing a while, but maybe they've gotten stagnant or something. So tell us a little bit, if you experience writer's block, what are some good ways you've gotten yourself out of it? And if you don't experience it, why do you think that is?
Well, you know, it's great. That's a great question because, of course, my pre-COVID answer would be, you know,
that's everybody's answer. By pre-COVID,
right? Everybody's answer.
When I got PC answer pro-COVID,
right? Exactly pre-COVID.
Post-COVID.
So when I would get stuck, and I don't think necessarily think of it as right, but when I would get stuck in a, you know, I sort of write myself into a corner. Or I couldn't mm-hmm. figure out quite, you know, where I wanted to go. You know, I would go to the gym and you know, work out a little bit and just sort of relax and, you know, kind of work a little sweat maybe. And then you kind of, it just would kind of come to me. You know what I mean? It would just kind of, or maybe because I was just so relaxed and I wasn't thinking about it. And then it was, you know, but now, of course, I don't have that, you know, I don't have that luxury. And so, you know, gone on hikes and I've sort of done some makeshift weights around here, but that's, you know, it's not the same. But even now, I guess I should say, I guess my answer is always like, you can't sweat it. You can't overthink it. You just gotta, if you're stuck, if you know, you can't seem to go forward, go write something else or go think about something else or go watch a movie, go read something. In fact, yeah, do any of these other things. And I think if you can relax, I think if you can kind of, you know, decompress or take some of the stress away, I think that helps. Now, you know, knock on wood, I don't think I've ever had writer's block per se. I've certainly gotten stuck in parts and I've certainly gotten, you know, jammed up, but I've never had it so much that you know, a day or two later, I couldn't go back and mm-hmm. figure out what I want to do to go forward.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that's to say is that, but one of the things I think that helps me is I try not to overthink it. I guess that's really if I would say anything else, I guess that's my byword, which is to say, don't overthink it. Just, you know, take it slow. It'll come to you, or go do something else, go write something else.
Right.
And then you come back to it. You know, the great story is that, Walter Gibson, the guy who wrote, the Shadow, you know, the majority of those Shadow stories, there's a lot of, you know, ghostwriters who wrote Shadow and Doc Savage, etc. But Walter Gibson apparently, and I've heard this story several times, so I don't think it's apocryphal, I think it's a true story. He had his own, because, you know, he made pretty good money writing The Shadow. Because at one point, The Shadow was, he had to grind out two stories, mm-hmm. two novel-length stories.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, yeah. So apparently, you know, he had his own private train car. And he would have three or four typewriters, you know, lined up. Because, you know, because he always had to keep so far ahead of the Shadow stories. And he'd be working on one Shadow story, and he'd get to a part where he want to stop, or he just, you know, is kind of stuck. and the story is he goes to the next typewriter and kind of read the, you know, sort of look through the pages that he had, kind of get familiar with the story, and he start working on that story.
Wow.
He gets stuck on that story, and he go to the next time, you know, so that, so I, sure. I keep that in my head. I keep that in my head to think that, okay, if I get stuck, if I'm jammed up, just stop, go do something else, go write something else, and believe, and I do believe this, it will free you up. It will unlock something in some part of your brain that you can then circle back and get to the that story you the other story you want to tell.
Yeah,
there you go. Hey Gary, there's a question for you. Who knows what evil lurks?
That's right.
We're gonna
take
another real quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block. We'll be back right after this brief word from Creative Edge.
Hi, Jim Christina from the Writer's Block here with some great big news. If you're an author or inspiring to be one, then you better check this out. Creative Edge, one of Canada's top boutique publicity firms for authors, is now expanding. They are dedicating themselves to promoting authors, indie and traditional, in all walks of life, all genres, and they're looking for all opportunities. Owned by Mickey Mickelson, Creative Edge has the passion, the contacts, and the knowledge to help authors and other artists build their brand and get their work noticed. You can contact Mickey at mickey.creativeedge@gmail.com to get started, or you can go to www.creative-edge.services. Creative Edge Publicity, it's your brand, it's your future.
And, of course, the answer to that question, Gary, is the shadow knows.
That's right.
We only got a few minutes. There's a chance to contact you directly. If you wouldn't mind telling me your email address or your website or your Facebook address.
I am on Facebook. I guess it's just, I don't seem to have an author's page on Facebook, or maybe I can't seem to figure it out, but I'm there on Facebook, and you're pretty easy to find. And then through my website, it's just, gdphillips.com, but they can always send me a message through my website. Yes.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And you know what, it's always a pleasure having you with us. And
well,
you know, I hope you remain a part of the Writer's Block family, because we love having you on this show.
Well, thank you so much, Jim. I really appreciate that. You and Bobby having me on. I really dig it.
Well, we love having you on, and we love your stories, and we're a big fan now of pulp noir. And please, when you get another book coming out, let us know. Let the bookie know. She'll get you booked for another spot.
Absolutely.
It's not going to be right away, because we are booked up halfway through the next year. So,
oh, excellent. That's great. That's wonderful.
But you've been waiting since June. So, I mean, you know, hey.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and where am I? Anyway. And where am I going? You know what I mean? Where am I going?
Exactly.
You know?
You're not going anywhere.
Do we all get vaccinated? We ain't going nowhere. So, you know,
holy moly! I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Okay.
Exactly. What are you going to do?
Gary Phillips, we appreciate you spending your evening with us.
I appreciate you guys.
We have other places to be, and so
right on.
We appreciate it. Well, not right now, but sometimes.
That's right. Sometimes. That's right.
Okay. It's Gary Phillips. Dear Gary Phillips, folks, and we just really appreciate him being on this show. Next week is our last live show of the year. Our guest is Gary Farron. He has written a book called After Abbey Road. It's all the Beatles music that came after the band broke up. And my God, it's like every song has got a page on how it came to be and what it is. And holy crap. What a wonderful book this is. And if you're a Beatles fan, you cannot miss this show. So, Bobby.
Yes.
This is the last opportunity I'm going to have to say Merry Christmas to you.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to see you next year.
You are.
Or I'm going to hear you next year.
Unless you quit the show between now and then.
Yeah. Well, no, that's not going to happen. So, I know I'm already beginning...
No,
I'm beginning to already hear a little bit about who's coming on in January and February and March. And you know, yeah. Here we go into 2021.
We have a great, the bookie has done really great lineups for January and February.
Yeah.
So we got some really great authors coming on. So that being said, Merry Christmas to all of our listeners out there, from the Writer's Block to you. For Bobby G. Bell, of course, Russ Avison, which will be on with me next week. And, of course, Ronan Rosner and Sam Hassan and LA Talk Radio. We appreciate you listening to our show. And we have one more live show next week. And from there, we're going to be going into hiatus. So Merry Christmas to everybody. And we'll be seeing you next week. From all of us to all of you, we are out of here.